Almost exactly 10 years ago, on Sunday, September 15th, 2008, the investment bank Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. Within 2 days, the U.S. government had bailed out the insurance company AIG, and there were problems at a money market fund that had invested in Lehman Brothers' debt. By Wednesday, a lot of people believed that the contagion from the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy would collapse the entire American financial system.
How would you define the mood Wednesday morning?
Panic.
Panic.
John Authors is the chief markets commentator at the Financial Times, and he was reporting on the crisis that Wednesday.
Perhaps the best way to explain this is that people were so desperate to sell anything from a bank or from a normal company and put it into very short-term bills and bonds offered by the government, and known as T-bills, that the interest rate you could get off those bonds dropped to virtually zero. The last time it had been that low was Pearl Harbor. Yes, literally people were as scared and distrustful of the credit of banks and of companies as they had been at any time since Pearl Harbor.
And that afternoon, John went to his local bank branch at Citigroup, and he noticed something surprising, something that reinforced for him just how bad things really were. And it left him with a tough question. Do I report this thing I just saw, which as a journalist felt like his job, or would it be irresponsible to share it with the public and risk deepening a panic that was already so frightening? I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. Today on The Indicator, what John saw at his Citigroup branch and what it said about the financial system in a moment of crisis.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Swell Investing, an impact investing platform. Invest in high-growth companies of the future, innovating in clean water, renewable energy, and medical breakthroughs. Claim a $50 bonus through swellinvesting.com/indicator. Support also comes from Nuveen. As a top 5 global manager of commercial real estate, Nuveen invests in buildings that build investors' portfolios. Because when you invest in a world you're proud to leave behind, it isn't business as usual. It's investing by example.
On that terrifying Wednesday 10 years ago, John was writing about the crisis and also posting online videos about it for the Financial Times website. And he says he did not look so hot at that time.
My mother phoned me from England to ask if I was all right because I looked so ill. I looked as though I'd just seen a ghost. And so I'm used to making judgments that will make one bunch of investment bankers very angry. I'm used to hurling abuse at a company and reducing the share price, reducing the wealth for those who are investing in it. I can live with that kind of responsibility, no problem at all. This was something very different and a level of responsibility that was completely new to me.
And weighing on you.
And yes, and on all my colleagues.
But John wasn't just feeling the weight of his professional responsibilities. He also had a lot of personal exposure to the crisis, too. He had just sold his apartment in London, and so he had a big chunk of his nest egg, about $300,000, on deposit at his local bank branch, a Citigroup branch in Midtown Manhattan.
At the time, the U.S. government insured $100,000 of deposits per person at each bank in the U.S. So if Citigroup collapsed, which was starting to feel like a real possibility, John might lose $200,000 of the $300,000 that he had on deposit.
John says that a loss like this would have taken a long time to earn back. So he needed to do something.
And there was this obvious solution. That afternoon, he thought he would transfer half of his money from the Citigroup branch to a different bank, to a Chase branch right across the street. That way, he would double the amount of money that was insured by the federal government. So, a little after lunch, John set off to visit his Citigroup branch in Midtown Manhattan and the Chase branch right across the street. And there is something you should know about these two Midtown branches.
There were a number of big investment banking offices for which these branches of City and Chase were the most local, most convenient local branches.
They're surrounded by financiers.
Yes.
Who also themselves had their cash, their deposits at City and at Chase, at the branch where you went.
Yep.
And when John gets to the Citigroup branch, he first notices that it's really crowded for the middle of the day on a Wednesday. Not quite out the door crowded, but there is a long line. And in that line are mostly young and middle-aged men wearing obviously expensive suits. In other words, these are people who work on Wall Street. That's the basic demographic. And they all looked really worried. And so John pokes his head out the door and he sees that there's also a really long line at the Chase branch. So John waits in the line at Citigroup, and after a little while, he gets to speak with someone who works there.
And I tell her I'm wanting to take some money out, take out half my money. She says, why do you want to do that? Do you want to put it in Chase by any chance? And I said, why, yes. And she produced bullet points. She told me she and her opposite number at Chase had agreed between each other. So it was obvious that quite a number of them at both those two banks had had people coming in with the same plan I had, saying, no, you don't need to take any money out from Citi.
She said that instead of transferring some of his money to Chase, John could open new accounts at Citi in trust for each of his two kids, plus a joint account with his wife, and that all those new accounts would be insured by the government. So his problem was solved. But John was startled by what the Citi employee had just told him, that all day long, so many people in line at his bank and at Chase across the street were doing exactly what he was doing. So many that the banks had an agreement between them, that they would open these new accounts for people instead of sending deposits back and forth between the two branches.
This kind of anecdote, that Wall Streeters themselves are in line at their personal bank branches, was not something John had seen reported anywhere else. And as a journalist, his instinct was to start his next newspaper story with that very anecdote, maybe even with a photo of the crowded lines at the Citi and Chase branches.
This would have been the image to make utterly clear what was going on. Rich Wall Streeters who really knew what was going on, getting the hell out of their office and into their local bank to shift their money around.
John says that finance journalists like him were working really hard to accurately report just how bad things were in the financial system. But he also felt a duty, he says, not to over-dramatize things, because that would risk contributing to the panic and creating an even bigger catastrophe, maybe even a run on the banking system in which people would rush to take their money out. So he had a choice to make, to reveal what he saw or to keep it to himself. He kept it to himself. He did not report it.
John says he still feels like he made the right decision. Even though the readers at the FT seem to disagree, John just wrote a column explaining why he withheld that story and says that about 3 out of every 4 commenters are criticizing him for not revealing it.
And there is something fascinating about the dilemma itself. Any financial system, no matter how well designed, will always have some small risk of finding itself in a crisis. And at that moment, there's a kind of insoluble problem. On the one hand, it is unfair for some people to have accurate and comprehensive information about what is really going on, while other people don't have all that information. On the other hand, there is a risk that if everyone has all the information, not just the data, but also anecdotes like the one John witnessed at the bank, it could make the crisis itself a lot worse.
And that is the nature of finance. And in a way, it is also human nature. Sometimes it can be easy to overinterpret the meaning of a single story. And sometimes we act in ways that are perfectly sensible for us as individuals, but that can hurt us collectively. Like if you are taking your money out of a bank because you worry that everyone else will take their money out of a bank.
John says that's a reason why an important part of what journalistic institutions do, especially in a crisis, is editing.
You do not want me to download the transcripts of every one of the interviews I have before I write a column. You really do not want that. It's unreadable. There's a lot of it. A huge part of what journalism is the editing function. It's not just finding the information. It's editing it and processing it.
Finally, John reminds us that next time will really be different, because 2008 was just before everyone had a camera and social media apps on their smartphones. So John wouldn't have had to call a photographer to share a picture of bankers waiting in line to move their money around. Anybody could have tweeted it out instantly. And from now on, they almost certainly will.
Which means that in the next crisis, which hopefully won't be for a very long time.
Or ever.
Yeah.
Possible.
We won't be left wondering if it's a good or a bad thing for everyone to have all the information and all the anecdotes instantly in a financial crisis. We'll know the answer because everyone will.